The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Advertising Corporation and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found in his Washington Times Communities column, Forbidden Siegel Talk.
It's time now for The Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but sometimes what Christians call an answer to prayer can be explained in other ways. Maybe the reason somebody got over their cold is that a couple of days after you get a cold, you just get over your cold. So what if somebody prayed that you'd get over your cold? Well, yes, that's true. Sometimes it can be explained in other ways. Other times, it cannot. It can be explained only one way. We'll discuss this provocative subject in just a few minutes. We also have two fascinating guests on the second half of the program, an author and publisher, Amir George and Ron Chepsik. Their book, Liberating Iraq, chronicles the untold story of Iraq's Assyrian Christians. And included in our talk, you're going to find this very interesting, what happened to those weapons of mass destruction from the point of view of an Iraqi? I know you're not going to want to miss this. That's coming up in the second half of the Bob Siegel Show. First, the latest news. While the world anxiously awaits President Obama's decision about Syria, which he's now going to make with Congress. First, he wasn't going to work with the Congress. Now he is. But anyway, while all this is going on, you know, there's always a lot of stories going on with Obama. One's never enough, and some of them stay under the radar because people have to prioritize. There is another important news story. It's getting far less attention. I'm betting half of you, more than half of you, never even heard of this. Did you know that the Obama administration, through Eric Holder's Justice Department, and it's hard to say justice with a straight face when I'm talking about Eric Holder, but Obama, through Eric Holder's Justice Department, is suing the state of Louisiana. Now, why is our president suing a nice little state like Louisiana over vouchers, school vouchers that give people an opportunity to go to a private school? This lawsuit is a catastrophe from every angle, including the moral argument for the suit, the constitutionality of the suit, and the timing of the suit, which I find very suspicious. This latest Obama-Holder collaboration will block a program that is actually helping a lot of minorities. Ironically, concern for minorities is the stated purpose in taking action against Louisiana. The DOJ is trying to stop 34 school districts from handing out private school vouchers. Supposedly, such vouchers work against the integration process. A remaining 10% of children with vouchers come from 22 school districts that received desegregation orders. Reacting to this state order, the DOJ says the voucher recipients were in the racial minority at the public school they attended before receiving the voucher. Wall Street Journal did a good job of summing up the lawsuit's logic. Wall Street Journal said Justice is claiming that the voucher program may be illegal because minority kids made their failing public schools more white by leaving those schools to go to better private schools. In fact, vouchers do embrace the true spirit of integration. They level the playing field by allowing all children an alternative to public schools. And there, I know there are a lot of good public schools, but sometimes they're academic failures. Sometimes they're dangerous places where many children feel like they're just being tossed to the wolves. It's difficult to see why Obama and Holder would not be in favor of vouchers, especially since their own children attend private schools. How do you like that? But alas, teachers' unions do not like vouchers, and teachers' unions support the Democratic Party. Democrats must stay in power if Obama is going to recreate America in his own image. Mystery solved. Look, all mode is put aside. The action is also unconstitutional. The federal government is not allowed to interfere with individual states unless it can be proven that they violated our federal constitution. That doesn't seem to make any difference to President Obama. He treats the Constitution as little more than a suggestion box, which the company executives read twice a year so they can have a good laugh together. And then again, with the right judge, Obama can at least do a quick photo op with the Constitution. With confidence, the wheels of Obama's Louisiana lawsuit have been set in motion. The outcome can easily go either way. If a judicial activist judge doesn't like private schools, 22 school districts will have to stop handing out vouchers. Their only hope will be appeal. On the other hand, if the court actually reads federal and state constitutions instead of interpreting them, then Obama and Holder will be stopped, but only for about 5 minutes, because Obama will then fall back on his default setting, executive order. You see, judges' rulings to Obama are only the final word when they agree with him. How does our president and his attorney general get away with end runs around our governing doctrine? The timing is everything. With so many outrageous foreign and domestic decisions in the news, coupled with investigations that Obama likes to call phony scandals, the strategy seems to be that of doubling down and hoping the country will simply grow numb to an administration that does whatever it pleases. The Louisiana lawsuit has not been a secret, but hardly anybody is talking about it outside of Louisiana. In the midst of one Obama news item after another, the media must prioritize. Obama's advisors may have calculated that the middle of a current foreign crisis is the perfect time to move forward with a little extra mischief. Even when a few reporters do cover the Louisiana lawsuit, others are busy and they're splitting their time because they're covering the Texas lawsuit where Obama and Holder are trying to block voter ID. Yeah, that's horrible. Horrible. Ask somebody to show ID while they're voting, that's racism. Ask them to show it everywhere else, at the airport, at a motel. Well, then that's not racism. Meanwhile, both Texas and Louisiana stories must be shared with Benghazi, Fast and Furious, the IRS scandal, and so many other issues that nobody can keep up with them all. It seems Obama's best strategy is to stay off the radar of media outrage by using his other controversies as camouflage. The Department of Justice has turned the word justice into a traditional but no longer meaningful word. You know who they're becoming like? I'll tell you exactly who they're becoming like. Motel 6. You remember Motel 6 was so named because once upon a time, the rooms actually went for $6. Due to inflation, motel rooms cost much more now. The name Motel 6 was still kept. Why? Because the public got used to it. They grandfather clause the name. It's like calling tissue Kleenex. Motel 6 still gets credit, though, for offering relatively inexpensive rates, thus embracing the spirit of their name. No such concern. Seems to keep Obama and attorney Holder up at nights. The day may come when future school teachers from public and private schools alike have to explain to their students what the word justice once meant. This is Bob Siegel, making the obvious obvious. Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated, license number 480539. WNS Electric. Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. Our theme, Christianity and its relationship to politics and pop culture. And I do have a Bible question, or a question about Christianity at least. This is from Diana. She says, "Hi, Bob. I have a question. Lately, there have been a lot of people in my life and friends' lives that need prayer. So myself and friends have been praying for them. I don't mean to, but I catch myself seeing if the prayers are being answered, and I have noticed if it's about health concerns, the prayers are being answered. I feel like I am checking up on God to see if he is listening, and I'm kind of keeping a tally. In my head, it's kind of like a baseball game where I know the score. So far, answered prayers are winning. I feel guilty doing it, but somehow in my brain, I won't stop. I'm afraid God might stop answering my prayers where these people need them answered so desperately. Am I doing something wrong?" And that's part of her question. Then she goes on, and it's related, but it's also a different question. "Two people I have continued to pray for are not Christians and are non-believers. God has answered my prayers about their health, but will he continue if they do not give him credit for it? They both have cancer, and after prayer, the doctor in both cases has come back to them and said the cases aren't in the far stages as was first diagnosed. They are both such non-believers that I only told them once that I was going to pray for them, even though I continue to. If I even mention God, they look at me like saying, 'Yeah, right.' One has asked a mutual friend, 'Why is Diana so nice?' The friend said, 'Because she's a Christian, and that's how Christians are.' So I try and show my belief system through my life without talking about it so I can remain friends with them. Yet I wish they would acknowledge God. What do you think?" Well, I think, first of all, Diana, the fact that they think of you as a nice person goes miles and miles and light years. And then who knows? Maybe they might start thinking that there is a God and that God is a nice person. But as for what you thought you were doing wrong about keeping score, well, Diane, you're not doing anything wrong. I know the phrase keeping score, is the way you put it, it carries certain connotations, like a husband and wife fighting, "Oh, you're keeping score on." But all I really hear you saying on the bottom line, all that I really think I'm hearing come out of your heart, is that you're noticing when God answers prayer. And you're also noticing when he doesn't answer prayer. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. In fact, we are invited by God through Scripture to bring our prayers to him. And God himself often reminds people of his answers to prayer. Continually, when he sent prophets to Israel, the prophet would begin by speaking in God's name. And almost every time they'd say, "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt," he reminds them that the supernatural deliverance from Egypt that included the parting of the Red Sea and clobbering Pharaoh's chariots, that was certainly an answer to prayer, prayers that the Israelites had made for many, many years. So God does not mind us noticing answers. On the other hand, when he doesn't answer as we would like or as quickly as we would like, we need to remember that this is God and not Aladdin's lamp. He answered prayers according to his will and purposes. And he would not want the kind of scorekeeping which said, 7 answered, but 20 unanswered. God loses. Sometimes even one single answer to prayer, if we look at it hard enough, it's enough to at least convince people that God exists. Should be anyway. There's a phrase that philosophers like to use. It's called Occam's razor. Now, it was actually originally developed by a monk, scholastic monk in the Middle Ages, but the phrase Occam's razor is actually embraced today by skeptics as a method for rational thinking. The rule says we must not multiply entities beyond necessity. How's that? Have I impressed you with my worthless intellectual rhetoric? Okay, now I'll explain what that means in English. Do not attribute to God something that can be explained by ordinary means. For example, and I brought this up at the top of the show, let's say you know a Christian brother or sister, because my atheist friends, they use this one a lot. So let's say you know a Christian brother or sister with a cold. They ask for prayer, and then a few days later they say, "Praise God, he healed me of the cold." One might answer back, "Hey, wait a minute, you were going to get over that cold anyway. We all get over colds after a few days. What you attribute to God, I attribute to antibodies." Now, a number of years ago, I had a Christian book table set up when I was a guest speaker out at the University of Washington in Seattle. And when I wasn't doing my speaking during the daytime, I'd love to talk and spar with students out in their free speech area. And a philosophy student, graduate philosophy student, stopped by and asked me if I had ever heard of Occam's razor. I told him I had and quickly paraphrased its principle. Don't attribute to God something that could be explained otherwise. Well, I got to tell you, the student seemed taken back. He may not have been under the aware that Christians ever do anything but study the Bible. So I think the fact that I knew something about a subject outside of the Bible, I think that itself impressed him. He was surprised. I knew something about philosophy. The example of prayer for the cold was brought up by him, and he said, "This is why I do not believe in miracles or answers to prayer. They can all be explained by other means." And I said to him, "Well, friend, when we're talking about a cold, I completely agree with you. But let me tell you a story about something that happened to me. I would attribute this to God, and you tell me if there's a better, more logical explanation than God." He says, "Okay." And then with patience and, I must say, considerable interest, he listened to my story. Here's the story, I told him. When I was a college student, I knew everything. Now, I'm in my late 50s now, and I don't know nearly as much as I knew many, many years ago. At the very top of my arsenal of knowledge, I knew that the church I attended had major problems. For one thing, it was filled with hypocrites who did not walk with God nearly as close as, well, me, for instance. It was a large Baptist church, a beautiful building with a rotating stage, a fountain in the narthex, and the best sound system in the city. Now, as a college student, I thought, like, yeah, churches don't need those big buildings. And, you know, my friends, we used to nickname it Disneyland Baptist. Only one problem, the congregation decided to build this magnificent structure before they could afford it. They didn't have the money. They built it anyway. Loans were given out in the form of trust funds. As people in the church got older and needed to withdraw their trust funds, the church sank into financial quicksand. As a result, the pastor's messages began to change. Now, when you're going to church and your pastor starts to preach from Haggai or any of the other prophets that were associated with the rebuilding of the ancient temple, watch out. There's usually some building program. Almost every week he spoke about money and the importance of tithing or giving. People got sick of it. I got sick of it. The straw that broke the camel's back came under the title Faith Pledge. You know what a faith pledge is? It's a guilt trip invented by some Christians to incur action from other Christians. He said, "We need every member of our church to donate $100. And then a sneaky-looking smile formed on his face. "You say you don't have $100? Not a problem, not a problem. All we ask is that you pray to God and ask him to give you $100. If he does this, if he answers your prayer and gives you $100 completely out of the blue, as extra money, not part of your regular income, then can you promise to give this money to the church? That's all we ask." Well, who can turn down a deal like that? It's like the Godfather giving you an offer you can't refuse. I generally can't sit still when I pray. I'm too restless. I go into my backyard. I look up at the sky. I pace. I talk to God. That's what I did that afternoon in a house that I was sharing with a couple of roommates in college. And while praying, I was reminded of my pastor's request for the $100. And I said, "Well, God, those hypocrites were talking about money again." And then something very unusual happened. I felt like I was instantly hearing from God. Did I hear an audible voice? No, I did not hear an audible voice. God can communicate that way if he wishes, but more often than that, God places his thoughts in our minds, made possible by his indwelling Holy Spirit, as the scripture teaches. The reason I thought this was happening at this moment is that my thoughts suddenly changed. They weren't as arrogant. The new thoughts were much more mature than my usual thoughts, so I had to consider the possibility that it was God speaking. I had to consider that possibility that it was God speaking, and it seemed as though our conversation went something like this. He said, "True, Bob, they do talk about money too much in that church, but it really wouldn't hurt you to stretch your faith a little, would it?" I says, "Yeah, but God, I don't have $100. He says, "That isn't the point. The point is that if I provide $100 for you in an unexpected way, unrelated to your regular paycheck, will you give it to the church?" Now, I'm going to be honest with you, folks. I made the deal with God, but it was only out of guilt. There was nothing loving, unselfish, or altruistic about my attitude. I just wanted to appease my conscience and get God off my back, if indeed these thoughts were really coming from him. I says, okay, God, okay, if you really give me $100 out of the blue, completely unexpected, not part of my regular paycheck, well, then fine, I'll give the money to the church, but it has to be exactly $100, God, or I won't believe the money came from you. I'm not convinced you want anything to do with these hypocrites anyway, so you need to convince me by making it exactly $100, no more, no less. If I get $99.99, I will spend it. Two days later, I get a letter from my friend John. I had not seen John in 6 months. He did not attend my church. This was long before the days of the internet. He knew nothing of their $100 drive. Neither did he know anything about the prayer I had made. But I opened up the brief note that he mailed me by snail mail. You remember snail mail. I'm quoting him word for word. Dear Bob, God recently blessed me with a large sum of money, and he laid it on my heart to give you this amount. Inside was a check for exactly $100. Now, flash forward in time to my conversation with the philosophy student at the University of Washington. I said, okay, Occam's razor, don't attribute to God what can be explained another way. The most logical explanation is the explanation we must accept. Explanation one, I said, there is no God. When I was in the backyard, I thought I was talking to God, but I was really talking to myself. Nobody heard me besides the neighbor's dog, and he wouldn't have understood. And then 2 days later, by an amazing coincidence, according to complete randomness and chance, the very $100 I asked for, I received. Or explanation two, there is a God. The reason I got $100 is because I asked God for $100 and he heard me and he answered my prayer. The student's mouth was wide open. He says, that's the most incredible story I ever heard. If something like that happened to me, I'd become a Christian. My friends, let us not view logic as an enemy of Christianity. Oftentimes, explaining things according to the handiwork of God is far more logical than the alternative explanation. Fluke, coincidence. This is Bob Siegel making the obvious obvious.
Kids ask you questions about God and the Bible that you can't answer? Sign yourself or your child up for a class with lots of solid answers at educateforlife.org before someone else gives them the wrong answers. Are you tired of not knowing what to say when your friends and family ask you questions about God and the Bible? Get equipped by signing up for a class at educateforlife.org. When someone asks you, "How do you know the Bible's true?" do you say something like, "I just know it is"? If you're tired of giving lame answers, sign up for a class at educateforlife.org. When someone says that God isn't real, wouldn't it be fun to prove that he is? Quickly, like a verbal ninja? By using science and logic. Sign up for a class at educateforlife.org with Christian apologetics teacher Kevin Conover, and you'll learn how to do that. Educateforlife.org.
Welcome back to KCBQ 1170. I'm your host, Bob Siegel. I won't be with you next week. I'll be on a speaking tour all weekend, kind of an extended weekend, in fact, Saturday through Monday. But even though I'll be out of town, the Bob Siegel Show will air at its usual time. Matt Simone will be substitute hosting for me. He always does a terrific job. That's attorney Matt Simone, always interesting, always provocative. You won't want to miss what he has to say. But let me also tell you where I'm going to be next week, because I would really appreciate your prayers. I'm going to be working again with Arabic Christian Perspective. Now, my ongoing relationship with them has been a rich blessing and adds to the eclectic nature of my ministry. They are offering a series of debates and sermons, and a variety of churches in Southern California are going to be hosting them, coinciding roughly with the anniversary of 9/11. This is an annual event, As part of this speaking tour, I'll be giving a series of talks which teach and inspire Christians to walk that delicate tightrope of reaching out to Muslims with the love of Jesus, all the while understanding the dangers we face when people do not take the threats of militant Islam seriously. My part of the program will culminate in a special debate in Chino Valley, California, on Monday evening at Calvary Chapel. I will debate Shadid Lewis, a Muslim apologist, and our debate is entitled, Can We Trust the New Testament? Mr. Lewis, although very religious himself as a devout Muslim, has brought into a lot of atheist ideas about the New Testament, ideas not supported by any accurate first century scholarship. And ironically, the Quran, which Mr. Lewis accepts, does not claim to be an alternative to the Bible, but rather a sequel to the Bible. The Quran explicitly states that both the Old and New Testaments are the Word of God. They say that in the Quran. But then, paradoxically, in other places of the Quran, it claims that the copies of the Bible have been corrupted. Unfortunately for this theory, Muhammad taught much from the Bible in his day, and yet the originals did not survive for anybody to read beyond the early 2nd century. Since Muhammad lived in the 7th century, at a time when only the so-called corrupt copies of the Bible were available, on what basis did he teach from the Bible? This is but one of the many points I will be making in the debate. Please pray not only for this debate, but several other debates with other participants being offered that same weekend, along with the many seminars and sermons being presented by a variety of Christian speakers. Incidentally, if any of you are in the Chino Valley area, or if you'd like to take a pilgrimage to attend my debate, remember Calvary Chapel, Chino Valley, Monday, September 9th, 7 o'clock to 9 o'clock p.m. For more information, such as directions, you can go to the Calvary Chapel, Chino Valley website. That's calvaryccv.com. Oh, by the way, if you're hearing this program as one of the many replays on KCBQ or KPRZ the following weekend, or if you're hearing this off my website after the fact, pray anyway. Yeah, you heard me correctly. Just pray anyway. I see your jaw drop into the ground. I see that expression on your face, wondering if Siegel is certifiable. Pray anyway. The Bible says God is removed from time. You can still pray. Isaiah the prophet says, before they call, I will answer. God speaking through him. Now, does that sound bizarre? Yeah, it sounds bizarre. So what? Pray anyway. Okay, so that's what I'm doing next weekend while Matt Simone fills in. Meanwhile, I'm still here now. I'm going to read a few comments from one of our shows from a couple of weeks ago. You can always weigh in, questions at bobsiegel.net. That's questions at bobsiegel.net. Now, I talked a couple of weeks ago about the Obama speaking to a group of high schoolers and calling all these scandals, such as Benghazi and the IRS, phony. Carl says, believe me, Mr. Siegel, they are phony. What you really have are media scandals, scandals invented by the likes of Representative Issa and his fellow witch hunters to make everyone think there's something horrible going on. Okay, Carl, you sound pretty sure of yourself. Fine, back up those words. If you're listening, send me something. Go on. Back them up. I don't think I'm going to be holding my breath. Now, Discus quotes from my Washington Times communities column version of this story. He quotes me where I said, although President Obama now calls the alleged scandals phony, he sang quite a different tune when they first hit the news. He says, yeah, he sang quite a different tune until they were researched and found to be phony. Discus, that is simply not true. Fact after fact has been uncovered. Whistleblowers have come forward. Both Obama and Eric Holder have been caught telling lies. One woman from the IRS even pleaded the fifth. Now, why did she do that when there was nothing to hide? I have written articles about these scandals. I have documented the facts. But if you don't want to read my articles, there are hundreds of others to choose from. Then again, if you're merely an Obama groupie, you might not want to confuse yourself with actual facts. This is Bob Siegel making the obvious obvious.
If you enjoy listening to The Bob Siegel Show, check out Bob's weekly column for Washington Times Communities. Bob is also a regular contributor for San Diego Rostra and San Diego Newsroom. And don't forget his website, www.bobsiegel.net, S-I-E-G-E-L, bobsiegel.net. Here, you can download past radio shows, read Bob's many articles about Christianity, and get information about Bob's books. That's www.bobsiegel.net.
Back to the Bob Siegel Show. I'm very honored to have both of these guests. Let me introduce them and tell you about them one at a time, and then we'll put them both on the air. Amir George is an Assyrian Christian whose family is from the northern Iraqi town of Muhadi. His new book, entitled Liberating Iraq, chronicles the untold story of Iraq's Assyrian Christians. And it seems that a lot of people in the world, some of them probably never even heard of the Assyrian Christians. And you think of the Assyrians as an ancient people from long ago, as they were, but there's a lineage and it's still there. And this book is based upon Amir's own personal insights as an Assyrian Christian over a period of several years. Most interesting, in his book, it tells what happened to the weapons of mass destruction. Now, I brought a guest on this radio show many years ago that said those weapons were there and were shipped out. It'll be interesting to hear this from the point of view of an Iraqi. Also joining us today, Ron Chepsik. Ron is the publisher of Amir's book, Liberating Iraq, but that's the least of what he does. He's also an award-winning author in his own right, a documentary producer, director, and screenwriter. He's authored 35 books and more than 4,000 magazine and newspaper articles. Ron is also a consultant to the History Channel's Gangland TV and executive producer and host of the popular radio show Crime Beat. Wow, that is quite a resume. I'll have to also ask him if he speaks 7 different languages and is ambassador to Sweden. That wouldn't surprise me at all. Ron Chepsik and Amir George, welcome to our program.
Hello.
Hello, gentlemen. Ron, let me talk to you first, because I was talking to you both at the same time. Ron, are you there?
Yes, sir.
Ron, why don't you, I had a lot on your resume, and we know Amir and his background in the book, but why don't you introduce your friend for us, and along with that, tell me how the two of you met, and then I'll ask him a few questions.
Amir has written a really interesting book about the Assyrian Christians in Iraq. And I'm the publisher of Strategic Media Books. We're a new emerging publisher, and we do a lot of crime and international subjects and some other genres. And I had struck up a relationship with Amir's agent, and she had mentioned this book, and I thought it was very interesting, the subject matter, and it was already done. And I read it, and I thought it was a good book. So we decided to publish it, and it's just come out in July, and now we're starting to promote the book.
And what has the response been so far since it came out in July?
It just came out a couple of weeks ago. We've been on several shows. We're lining up several big cable interviews with Fox and CNN and the Christian Broadcasting Network, and hopefully some of these leads will come to fruition in the next couple of weeks. And but it's a really timely book with what's going on in the Middle East right now, and so we think that we've got a real interesting book that can really hit a chord.
It sure does. Since you're also a filmmaker, are there any plans or discussions at this point about making a documentary film out of the book too?
I think you'd have to talk to Amir about that. We haven't talked about anything in that area, but maybe Amir's got plans. I know he's really interested in this area, and he's an expert in this area, and he's probably going to be coming out. I know you may want to talk to him. He's collecting stories too, which is very interesting. I just found out when I interviewed him for my own radio show, Crime Beat Radio on the Artist First Network, And you may want to talk to him about that. I think that's very interesting.
Well, we could settle the whole deal right here on the air. We could draw up the contracts. I'll arbitrate. Okay. All right. Well, hang on, Ron, because I have a lot of other questions I'm going to want to ask you, too. But I want to bring Amir on. Amir, welcome to our show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's an honor to have you, sir. Now, your book was drawn from meetings with the Iraqi prime minister, president, foreign minister, top U.S. and international officials, and the Iraqi people themselves. That is fascinating. What was your connection with such high-level people?
Well, I think, first of all, we were there before the war. We brought the first relief truck of supplies right after the war. And, you know, as you can imagine, right after a war, things are pretty much in flux. So it's basically whoever got there first kind of knew everybody, and it developed from there. That's probably the best way to put it.
Okay, now I have a lot of questions that I want to ask you, but when I read that it includes what happened to the weapons of mass destruction, you know how radio is. Probably a lot of people in our audience are so eager, and we're going to talk about a lot of things. I want to make sure we don't miss that. What did happen to the weapons of mass destruction? What do you know? Who told you? This is just fascinating to me.
Well, it's fascinating to everybody, to be perfectly frank. All I can say is that, first of all, one of our distant relatives was actually a part of the situation right before the war, and directly says they flew part of them into Iran, they flew other parts of them into Syria, and then other parts of them they buried in the desert, and we detailed in the book, you know, we had a number of conversations, and the conversations were always very strange because nobody really could talk about it. But what seems to be the best, and there was just a piece out last week, I think, in Foreign Affairs magazine that chronicles this, where essentially what happened was there were all the weapons that, you know, we thought they were, but they had been from a previous generation, and most of them were ours as well as our allies. So I think everyone was stuck with this, you know, catch-22 situation. Either you say we couldn't find them, or you say we found them and they're ours, each of them being equally difficult, and they chose, as far as we can tell, we couldn't find them.
Now, are you familiar with the name Georges Sada? He was the... had something to do with the Air Force there. He came on a speaking tour in America not long after that war started, and he claimed that not only were they shipped out, but that some of them were even put on commercial airlines. Does that coincide with any information you've been privy to?
Absolutely. That's exactly the facts. Yeah, they were flown to Iran. They were shipped across the border to Syria and then buried in the desert. So, you know, the situation in Syria that's developing in many ways, you know, is connected to this. So we're, in a sense, kind of seeing a deja vu. But at the end of the day, you know, what do you do? Everyone says it, and everyone looks both ways and tells you. But I think the best in the book we talk about where there was a couple of troops there that looked at us and said, you know, what do you do if you find something and it turns out to be yours? That's probably the best characterization that we can come up with.
Yeah, this is pretty amazing. Amir, why do you suppose this hasn't made more news? It's almost like people gave up on looking for them. Right? I know they looked for a while. And, of course, the big slogan in America is Bush lied, people died. But why do you suppose this isn't making more news? This is huge and very connected to all the stuff that's still going on in the Middle East. Especially since there was a gassing and chemical weapons in Syria just in the last week.
Right. I think the piece that came out just last week in Foreign Affairs was very detailed. It might be good to, you know, to ask the readers to check that out. But it goes into great detail about exactly how it happened. And, you know, a lot of stuff just doesn't make news. It's the kind of thing where everybody knows about it, but those that know, and those that don't know at all. But you can see the tension between the two views. In other words, in the beginning, they couldn't find it. So,
Amir, hold on just a second. Are you talking on a cell phone or a remote phone?
No, we're fine. We're on a regular
phone. Okay, because you're starting to cut in and out. Are you pacing and walking at all while you're talking?
No.
Okay, well, you were just loud and clear in the first few minutes, and now we're having some bad connections. But okay. I'll go ahead and continue as long as I can. I interviewed a guest on my show a number of years ago. His name was Victor Mordecai. He was an expert on terrorism, and his wife worked in Israeli intelligence. And he said the same thing that you did, that the weapons were taken into Syria and other places. And I said to him, if Israeli intelligence knew that, George Bush had to know that. And I asked him, why would the Bush administration not vindicate themselves? Before I tell you what his answer was, do you have any idea about that? In the information that you've been given, have you been told anything about whether the Bush administration actually knew that there were weapons and yet they somehow allowed the story that there weren't any weapons to continue floating?
Yeah, I think we have that in the book. I was at a meeting a few years back with a person very, very close to the administration. In his speech, mentioned.
Okay, Amir, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to ask Nick to try to work with you to get a better connection. Maybe we can call you back. But while we're doing that, Ron, let me bring you on and ask you some questions. Mm-hmm. Now, Ron, what is your own background? You told me that you met this agent and another right and got very interested in this book.
Right. I talked with her, but I've been a writer for 25 years. I'm a former university professor. And I've been to Indonesia and Bangladesh as a Fulbright scholar. And I just sort of, some writers, specialize in mystery, some writers in, Christian literature. And I just ended up in crime writing, and basically nonfiction. And I've published several books in this area, and especially on the drug trade, which has always fascinated me. And, I've appeared on most of the cable news, Discovery Channel, Biography Channel, all those crime shows on various subjects. And now I'm going into moving into screenplays, and a couple of my books have been optioned, for a movie. And I'm hoping to get lucky and something will happen hopefully within the next 6 to 9 months.
Now, when you say screenplays, do you mean for movie fiction or screenplays
for
documentaries?
I do documentaries, so I've got three documentaries, but I'm talking about screenplays for feature movies.
And so, but the feature movies that you would like to write and produce would be similar to your nonfiction in that it might be fiction about crime?
Exactly. The two of my books, I got a book out now, which is doing well, called Black Caesar, The Rise and Disappearance of Frank Matthews Kingpin, one of the most interesting mysteries in organized crime history. I've done a screenplay for that, and that book's been optioned. And then I have another book that's coming out on the Cali Cartel, which is one of the biggest drug cartels in Colombia, and that's been optioned as well. And we'll see what happens. Only one out of every 100 movies that are optioned get made into a movie. And I've been around this for about a couple of years, and I know how difficult it is, to get a movie. Everything's got to be right. A movie made, everything's got to be right. You got to have the money. You got to attach a big star to the movie. You got to get a director, and then you got to get the money. And you're talking, 25 million and above for a major feature. So that's, it's all going to come together. It takes time, and you got to have a little luck.
Okay, it looks like we have Adir back with us again. Are you there, Adir?
Yeah. Can you hear me okay now?
Okay, yeah. Hold on, buddy. Yeah, we're hearing you loud and clear. Let me just finish this question with Ron, and then we'll come back to you. You sound much better. Glad we have you back. Hey, Ron, I just have to ask you this, since you're into not only nonfiction, but fiction about crimes and gang. What was the best gangster movie ever made?
Well, I mean, I can tell you what it is the best, and it's very obvious, The Godfather.
Absolutely.
But it's not my favorite. My favorite is The Bronx Tales.
Well, no, I haven't seen that one. Who stars in
that? It's starring Robert De Niro, and Chaz Palmieri did the screenplay, and it's a great story about a father and a son and a mafia guy, where the father tries to steer the son away from the life of crime because he lives right in the neighborhood. This is based in New York, so it's a very good, if you get a chance to listen to it, it's a real morality tale about about upbringing in a tough neighborhood, and how a father's trying to do right, and, you know, he's trying to stay away from the mafia. He's very honest, and they're trying to corrupt him, and his son is sort of drawn into it, and he's trying to fight the forces that are trying to draw him into it.
Yeah, Ron, what's your opinion of Hollywood movies as opposed to independent films? Do you have a preference?
Well, Hollywood movies are getting worse and worse. I mean,
Don't you find the endings are always really predictable?
Yeah, right. Like, I like thrillers, and I saw White House Down, and Olympus Has Fallen, and they were really hokey. I mean, they were so unbelievable. But, you know, the Hollywood's gone towards this blockbuster, trying to make huge amounts of money doing these blockbusters, the Avengers, Superman, and all that. And according to some of the stalwarts in the industry, like Steven Spielberg and some of those others, they're saying Hollywood's headed for a disaster because those movies aren't going to sustain Hollywood. They're going to have to do, you know, good old-fashioned dramas like the independents do. And get back to basics. And, you know, I didn't go to a movie this summer. I didn't see any movie. Every movie was made for a 10-year-old.
Well, you know, M. Night Shyamalan is popular because his right. movies are twists. But there was a time when almost every movie had a twist.
Oh,
and even in the way they preview them, I mean, even as if the ending were predictable anyway, you go to a preview, they show you the whole story. Now, Alfred Hitchcock, he knew how to preview a movie. You were dying to see it, and you didn't have a clue what it was about.
Exactly, but you don't see those type of movies anymore. That have a twist like the Hitchcock movies had, and sort of draw you into the movie. They're far and in between, but maybe independence will save Hollywood.
It just might. I mean, you could write these things in your sleep. In the cop movie, the chief of police ends up being the guilty guy.
Right.
He gets shot. He falls over. He's not really dead. He gets up again. When he does die, he falls from a high place. Mm-hmm. My theory. You can tell me if I'm right. My theory, because I'm a writer too. I believe that the original screenplay writers do not want to have the same ending as everybody else. I sometimes I'll watch a story that's really good, then I'll be disappointed to see right. the predictable ending. And I would guess that it had a better ending originally, and somebody sat around a big oak coffee table in a boardroom and said, "This standard ending sells,"
yeah,
and then they
exactly.
just went and changed it.
Exactly. You know, the formula that they use, because there's so much money involved, they don't like to take chances. You know what I mean? And so they'd rather stick with something. This is why they do so many remakes, you know, of sequels and big movies like Superman and a lot of these comic book characters and all that, because, you know, they don't want to take a chance, you know, on a quirky drama that, they have really no understanding of to begin with, and they have no feel for how it's going to do with audiences.
If you just tuned in, my special guests are Ron Chepsik and Amir George. Amir George has written a book that Ron has published. That's their connection. It's going to sound unconnected for a moment, though, because we're going to go from movies in Hollywood back to Amir, and we're going to talk again about the Middle East. But the connection, if you just joined in, is that Ron is the publisher of this book and has a lot of interest in these kinds of things. Amir, welcome back to our program.
Thank you.
And so I was, I had left off with you where, and I know you answered it, but it got a little garbled. I might want to ask you again. If the Bush administration knew that the weapons of mass destruction were there, and yet he came under all this criticism, was accused of lying, but he knew that a lot of the intelligence was not off and that they had been taken into Syria and other places, why didn't he speak up? And you said that in your book you addressed that, but we had a little trouble understanding your answer. So go ahead again.
Yeah, I think the best way I can put it is to be actually told by one of the military people right there on the ground in the middle of the green zone. I can't tell you, but what would you do if you found if you were looking for something that was supposed to be somebody else's and you found it and it was actually yours, was the way that he put it.
So, I see. So that these were weapons that Saddam had gotten from the United States somehow back when when we supported him in the war against Iran. Oh, okay.
Right. So
and I know you said that before.
Situation. Either you initially it couldn't be found. So, you know, the first message was they weren't found. But then apparently they were found later, but they turned out to be mostly ours. And
Boy, that makes so much sense.
I was at a meeting with an official very close to the administration a few years back who put it this way. He said one of the biggest mistakes that the administration made was not changing the narrative and announcing that they had been found. So either way, it was a catch-22. Either you say you can't find them, which has its own problems, or you announced that you found them and they were yours. So I think that was a tough call. But the reality is that as far as we can tell from, you know, from those that were part of it, from those that actually were there, that they were in fact there.
Boy, my friend, I've got to tell you, that makes so much sense. Yet people just been racking their brains. Now, the guest that I had on said something else,
though. I think the interesting thing to be on site in places is that you find that a lot of things that everybody knows, a small group of people know everything, and the rest of the people know nothing. This is kind of the catch-22.
Well, you know, and it's so obvious because we were supporting Iraq in the war against Iran at one time when the Ayatollah, or I think it was after the Ayatollah left power. No, I think it was when he was. But anyway, it's, at some point, we were supporting that war. Now, the guest that I had, Victor Mordecai, he sent out another idea. He felt that there was some pressure, or at least he hinted, I should say, that there was some pressure from Saudi Arabia. I said, why wouldn't Bush say anything? He said one word, O-I-L, oil. Do you believe that had anything to do with it, too, that somehow Saudi Arabia said, we don't want you messing with this, and that they were going to threaten to cut off our oil supply?
Well, I think, I think those kind of things touch every aspect of what goes on. But I think what at the end of the day, they face the very difficult point. In other words, I think the conclusion is that it would have been better to have said, we finally found them, and they were ours, but they were ours from a previous generation when it was a different war. And I think that could have been communicated.
Yeah, and just fess up. They were from us, but we would never have used them in this way. But, I mean, that would have been better.
I think I mentioned earlier, there's a very interesting piece this week in Foreign Affairs that discusses this in great detail. And it's very clear that that's really what happened, that they... the discussion was, how to handle them when they in fact were ours. But just really quickly, the other thing, you're in San Diego, so I think you have some probably many many people who actually served in Iraq, in your audience, and probably one of the biggest reasons we wrote the book was because it's broken my heart personally to see a lot of these people that serve. Most people don't realize that nearly 2.5 million Americans served at one time in Iraq. That's one for every 10 Iraqis. And about 32,000 were injured very seriously, and 4,888 lost their lives. So part of probably the biggest reason that we wrote this was to say a much belated thank you to them.
Now, you said you were there before the war began. Were you still there after the war began as well?
Oh yeah. We were there. In fact, we belong to a tribe. So I was going to stay there during the war, but the head of our tribe said, go out and, during the time of the bombing. So we went out and we brought the first relief truck to cross into the country following liberation. But the title itself, Liberating Iraq, is kind of a play on words, because the general consensus, right, when you say we liberated Iraq, these days everyone just kind of, smirks. Imagine being a family that lost a son or a daughter or a father or a brother, to think that that was all one big mistake.
And you'd like them to know that there's a lot of gratitude on behalf of the people and that their lives were not in vain.
Well, it's more than that, though. In the sense that whereas the military and the political and the whole project to liberate Iraq had a lot of problems. We pulled out way too soon. There were a lot of mistakes, and yet there was a second liberation. In a probably better way to put it is that there was really a spiritual awakening that took place and continues today, and it was that second liberation, the other liberation, in which 2.5 million Americans and Brits and people from many different countries, but especially Americans, I shouldn't say all, but most of them, godly, wonderful people, fanned out over the country. And these people were just, one of my relatives said, the best way I can explain it is we should all be in a mental hospital. And they just loved them back to on the way towards normalcy. And that liberation has absolutely transformed not only Iraq, but that's really at the basis of what's happening throughout the Middle East today. So you said earlier, one side of news gets out and one doesn't. The other side of the news that doesn't get out is that, in fact, because of what happened in Iraq and the second liberation, just as happened in, Japan and in Europe and in Korea, that is what triggered
Hello?
Yeah.
Yeah, we're down to our last couple of minutes. That's why you hear the music. Go ahead and quickly finish your thought there.
Well, we're trying to, as many that have served, working on a second book to chronicle their stories of how they liberated Iraq. And our website is liberating-iraq.com. We're on Twitter and Facebook.
Okay.
And we're hoping to...
And Ron, can you give us your website too?
Yes, it's www.strategicmediabooks.com. And that's STRATEGIC.
Okay, gentlemen, it's a pleasure. There's much more I could talk about with both of you, so we'll have you both on again sometime, okay?
Thank you. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
All right, God bless both of you. We'll see you next time, everybody.
The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.